Welcome to Side Hustle City, and thanks for joining us. Our goal is to help you connect to real people who found success turning their side hustle into a main hustle, and we hope you can too. I'm Adam Kaler. I'm joined by Kyle Stevie, my co-host. Let's get started. All right, welcome back, everybody, to the Side Hustle City podcast, and as always, the trusty co-host, Kyle Stevie.
This weather sucks.
It does suck. But Kyle's actually in the house today.
I know. I had to make an appearance because we've got a legend sitting here finally.
Yeah. Got another dot looper.
Yep.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, yeah. Alex Allison's with us, guys, which is pretty awesome. Alex was our first employee at Dot Loop, brother of Austin Allison, the founder, and pretty much our head marketing person. I used to go to soccer practice at NKU and then come on over to our office when we were in up in Blue Ash and just do marketing the rest of the night.
It's a hell of a drive.
Yeah. And his brother had put a lot of pressure on him. His brother had guilt everybody into working harder and they really wanted the work. So.
Yeah. It's interesting when you back up that story and look at how you figure out how to balance different things when starting a venture coupled with life and other things. It was a fun ride.
Well, and being young too also helped, I think, when you're not married, you don't have kids, you don't have all these responsibilities that you have, you know, like you, Kyle. I mean, right now, I mean, look at all the things you got to do with the kids. Like, I mean, you got two of them in college now, which kind of helps, but all the responsibilities that come with having kids, it makes it a lot harder, I think, to do stuff where, you know, Alex, while he was in college, started working at Dot Loop and, you know, he had some, you know, out of school responsibilities he had to do on top of his studies, but, you know, he was able to come in and work whatever hours he could and help us out with our marketing.
Yeah. Building on that, just like your understanding of how the world's supposed to work, you don't have that predefined notion of how the world should work. So you're kind of making it up as you go. I think that's one of the benefits that early stage individuals that are entering their career for the first time or chasing their life stream or whatever it might be, their craft. They don't have predefined notions of how it should look. So I think in a lot of ways that can help you figure out the path so long as you're resourceful in how you find that.
Yeah, I think it's like, it's got to be crazy, right? You're at NKU. You have business professors that have been really professional students their whole lives. And you are going from practice. You have classes prior to practice and you're listening to them talk. You have friends that are just going to go from practice to out to a club or a party. And then you go to, you know, balls to the wall, startup, like you're late. So let's get going because everybody else has been busting their ass. You got to catch up. We need to make this happen. Stuff's crazy right now. We got the opportunity to get this, get in with this realty group. We got this opportunity to get in with that realty group. We have this big conference coming up. We need to get our marketing campaign on point. And then you go back to class on Tuesday and you're like, you're learning these lessons and you're like, this isn't what I'm experiencing at all right now.
No, the textbook teaches it one way and the practical execution and the application of those learnings don't align. Like the textbook will teach you advertising and SEO and other types of business methods, but the actual execution around that isn't actually how it works. So there's a conflict of what's being taught in the real world versus what's actually needed or being applied in the real world and how those two come together. They're both relevant to one another. I think that's one of the biggest challenges for us in the future from an education standpoint is how do you align application in the real world against textbook standardization? There does need to be formality in textbooks and we need to have checks and balances in place, but the real world doesn't actually have that in the same way. So it's kind of an interesting dilemma. And I think resourcefulness is one of the biggest aspects that an individual can have when they're entering their career, regardless if they're starting a venture, because you have to be resourceful in how you apply what you're learning in the classroom whether or not it's a startup or not, you have to take what you're learning and saying, well, the textbook said this, here are the fundamentals. Now, do these fundamentals apply, or does the output change based on how I apply the fundamentals? So I think that's when you look at some of the, when you look at some of the great startups, I think there's a couple characteristics that they all had in common, and they had people that were open, to change, that were open to driving change. But they also had people that were resourceful in how they worked together to executing that change. So if you don't have that resourcefulness and that flexibility around your thinking, especially when dealing with multiple people, more than one, it makes it challenging to then go and apply the textbook. Does that?
Yeah, it totally makes sense. I mean, you've got that base learning that you have. What it doesn't teach you is all the pivots that you're going to have to go through. It doesn't teach you, there's no game plan for how you're supposed to go into a market with a new idea, mm-hmm. right? I mean, there sort of is. I mean, somebody can put something out there and say, hey, here's how we did it. Here's how we did it. But your specific problem is going to be different than what these guys did.
Well, your specific opportunity is going to be way different too.
Way different. I mean, look at Austin. You mentioned something earlier, Alex, about being young and not having these predetermined ideas. When Austin first came to me with the idea for Dot Loop, he was a realtor. He was 18 when he bought his first house. And I don't know, how old was he when we met? Like 21 maybe?
Yeah.
And you were, how old were you when you, we were?
18.
18?
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, you had just pretty much started college.
Just finishing up high school, entering college. And Austin basically came to me and said, hey, you know, I have this vision and we're building a team. You want to jump on board? And I had no experience at that time and said, sign me up, and just kind of ran into it head first. And I think that not having that predefined understanding of how I should have entered a career helped me just jump on board. I think it's ultimately what helps a lot of people jump on board as early founders and they're in their 20s. But what's interesting actually is when you look across the horizon, some of the most successful startups are actually from individuals that are later in their career. So it's really just, how do we define those? How do we define when someone enters or when someone, exits their career? I think the takeaway there is it doesn't particularly matter when you're entering your career. It's really just understanding some of the motives that you might have at that time. So if you're earlier on in your career, you're not going to have these predefined constraints or understanding of the world that might apply constraints. If you're later in your career, with respect to entering a new field or a new business model, there might be some learnings that you might have to break and or not take with you. However, you have that deep experience.
You know the industry, you know the players, you know the processes that most of the players are in, exactly. You know who they're connected to. When you're young, you have no clue. I mean, Austin was like, hey, why are we still faxing things? I mean, that was pretty much what he told me. He's like, hey, look, you know, every time we do a deal, and I had done several real estate deals before that because I was buying rental property, but he's just like, we're still faxing things. Mm-hmm. I'm like, you're right. Like, it took days for my offer to come back to me because I had to meet with my realtor, sign this paperwork on the back of a car. They take it to their office. They fax it over to the other office. The other agent, you know, the seller's agent might be.
Yeah, you get 72 days to sign it instead of.
It's like craziness, right?
Or it's 24 hours.
So essentially what we did was we digitized that entire process. And what was the amount? Like 90% of real estate agents are signed up to use Dot Loop probably?
Yeah, good majority of the of North America conducts their real estate transactions through Dot Loop. And I say that very specifically around conducts. We often talk about data and usage and the size of market share that one company has as a mechanism of measuring their scale or their influence over a marketplace or success. But there's different degrees of measurements within the context of just usage. Like often SaaS companies, software as a service companies, will talk about usage, what percent of usage they have within a given marketplace. You see that a lot across the real estate market, in which there's a lot of publicly available real estate data, and often we classify that as industry transactions or industry data. There's also this segment of people, call it realtors and real estate brokers, that make it all run. But yet we use some terminology there as if they're one and the same, but the reality is they're very different. So .loop, as you know, but for everyone listening, .loop, one element that was different about .loop was we enabled the transaction to happen from start to finish. So we weren't just focused on enabling someone to fill out a document quickly or, in the case of electronic signatures, just sign a document quickly. DocuSign would be a representation of someone that specialized in just signing a document very quickly. We focused on the simplest, easiest way to just do the transaction from end to end in a way that people could really digest. So a large majority of the industry were actually doing the transaction from end to end. So to get people to change that behavior and then facilitating not just an action in the process, but the full process from end to end is a really complex thing, but by itself, it's a very large achievement for a SaaS company because adoption is one of the hardest aspects of any new type of technology.
Well, I think one thing that helped .loop was we were solving a big problem. We were changing habit, which changing someone's habit, I think I read in the book Traction, something has to be 9 times better. And I don't know how you quantify this somehow, but it has to be 9 times better. Sounds and it could
like
be time. It
sounds like a bullshit number. It's like, not yeah. 10.
Like, how do you,
it's
how do
be
you,
more than 8.
Yeah. Yeah. How do you calculate
nine
that?
Sounds, 9 times.
9 sounds good, right? Good. It's not 10, right? Yeah. It's not double digits.
It's not impossible, but it's not weak.
But for us, I would say that you could measure that in time. You could say, how long does it take for a deal to get signed? You know, how long does it take that counterparty or whatever to sign the deal right now?
I think, I'm sorry, but I think it's as simple as, and I forget which Supreme Court justice said this, but it's like, I don't know how to define pornography, but I know it when I see it. And you may not be able to define the exact benefit of what you're doing, but you know it when you see it, when you don't have to drive to your office to fax the goddamn contract. You feel that convenience and you're like, ah, okay, I want to use this. It's so mm-hmm. much easier. Like just that basic, you know, just basics of humanity, the easiest path of the path of least resistance is always going to win. And if you can provide that, like you guys did, then
well, that was the game changer.
Yeah.
That was the game changer. But knowing that we needed to solve that problem first, mm-hmm. As we went, and this was something Alex had to do because he was in charge of marketing and listening to the customers, and we discovered there was more things we could add to that process to benefit. So you had that big home run and you get mm-hmm. people to switch over, and now they're like, hey, you know what would be great? What if you guys had document storage? What if you guys offered us a CRM? What if you guys did this? What if you guys did that? So it became a much bigger tool. And I just came back from a conference, this EXP conference in Vegas, and this big real estate conference. And, you know, Holly kept introducing me as, oh, he's a co-founder of .loop. Da, da, da. And they're like, I love .loop.
I saw that. It looked like a Southern Baptist revival.
It was crazy. Like people, like it was out of control.
People dancing on stage.
It was nuts. It was like
a
mega church.
For a rattlesnake to be thrown out.
No, I should have brought some. But it was crazy. Like people are, I love .loop, and they're chatting about .loop and all this other stuff. And they love it, right? They're like, you know, we just don't like Zillow. And that was a problem. Like, I mean, that was one of the issues we faced, I guess, when we were selling, was we got some backlash from some of our...
You know, what's interesting about what you just said there. You were talking about time and time savings. And I think for me in particular, being early and we often refer to marketing and branding as these categories. But the reality is for an early stage company, it's really go to market strategy. But it's how do you get your momentum going? How do you get your flywheel going? How do you get revenue going? Right. And you mentioned time. You think about time because you have a lot of things going on and you're measuring your value, but I don't know that the majority of the world measures that time in the same way. I think us as just humanity and society, we need this element of turning time on and turning time off. But when you apply that to the business world, it's hard for a SaaS company to quantify the benefits through time. So one application that, or call it method that we had to do, we found it very challenging to quantify the value on an operating tool. Even if we could say our transactions were 10 times faster, which they were, and that's a very sizable number, and especially for a profession that's generally, well, most professions back into some formula of getting paid based on time. Mm-hmm. It would suggest that you're making 10 times on your money, but that's not how people digest information. And what we finally had to do to make it stick in the marketplace is look at what everyone else was measuring, what they cared about. And what they really cared about was knowing that the majority of everyone else was using this platform. That provided confidence, that provided certainty, that provided validity. So we ran a test. This was very early on in our life cycle. We were an earlier stage company, and there were later stage companies in the space. We ran a test, and we surveyed all of the top real estate agents and real estate brokers in the country, and what that test came out. And we asked them a series of different questions. And what that test said about the space was that the top echelon of real estate companies utilized our platform four times more than any other company. So not just literally number two, the second company in that line, we were being utilized four times more. And we found that number to stick in a lot more impactful way across the industry, but more importantly, our marketing, sales, growth-oriented efforts, the things that drive commercialization across the business, we found that to be a lot more effective than time. And you look at that and say, well, shouldn't people care about the benefit that it's adding to them, the 10x savings on their time? So for me, that just highlighted from a marketing and brand perspective that we digest information in different ways. And
different industries do, too.
Different industries do.
Well, yeah. So you measure it in time. But if you're a 62-year-old real estate agent and you're forced to use this app because your brokerage is using it, but and you don't get frustrated using it, that it's easier, that's a value there too, where you're like not hating your life and hating your job using some shit program you don't want to use.
Well, I got to get in the car. I got to spend money on gas to drive to wherever this is to meet this buyer.
Yeah.
They got to put in the offer. And every time it changes, not only that, the contracts, every generation that you fax over, there's degradation in the document itself.
But what I'm talking about is you talk about value. So yours is based in time, but for there's another way of valuing it for just like a common normal person who doesn't think about their time value is more like, this is so much easier to use. I want to use this. Now time plays a component in it because they're on it for less time, but the frustration and the angst and the cortisol levels that go up when you have to use something you don't know how to use. And you're like, God damn, I got to put in all this information again. Like, this is awful. Why are they making me use this? And you guys present something that's so easy to use. So for you, that's time value. For them, it's like keeping them one step away from having a massive coronary.
Yeah, it's deep. It's emotional. And we all have that in our own lives in different ways, regardless of what we touch. And, you know, honestly, I at the end of this year, I might go back to a flip phone. There is a chance I might go back to a flip phone for that reason. I think we're inundated by information and apps and the rate at which things are changing.
Are you going to go Nextel? Are you so you can go?
Well, I don't even know where to start with flip phones. So if anyone has
isn't there a new Razor? Like getting the Razor phone out again?
I had to get first thing I ever got was a Nokia.
Yeah,
it was just like a little like square. And it had all the buttons underneath it. You could play a couple of video games on it, but.
Well, our applications aren't designed to work across applications, and they're also not designed to work across the operating system in which they live. But applications aren't designed in typically SaaS, software as a service business application, and applications. And I mean that through the lens of they're solving a deep process within your business. It's a little bit different than, say, a consumer app. A consumer app, you might be doing an action with a business software as a service application. You're kind of you're executing a series of things or a business process. Business applications haven't been historically designed through the lens of just straight simplicity. So, if you recall some of our first marketing assets, the front of it just said it's simple, and everyone said, well, you got to hit on benefits statements. You got to tell us what you do. And I just created a circle that said it's simple on the front of it. And to this day, when I meet people 10 years later, they'll come up and they'll say, hey man, I still remember that first circle that you guys released. And all it said was it's simple. And the takeaway for me there is I wasn't trying to convey a message other than we're focused on simplicity. And we know that that's a deep pain point that people have that far exceeds this need or ability to get documents signed fast. It's not getting documents signed fast. It's people just need a easier life. People just need the burdens removed and the friction removed. So we focused on simplicity first as our core function, which enabled us to differentiate ourselves both from a marketing and brand perspective. But so long as marketing and brand is aligned with product or product is aligned with marketing brand's vision, those two work in harmony together in a very amazing way. I think that's one area that I'm interested to see where it goes over the next 10 years. I think we're in this interesting period where we're getting access to so many powerful tools, advertising tools and ways to acquire customers. It can lead you to being disconnected from the brand identity, the brand equity that you're building and the connection that that has with the underlying product. So I'm curious to see where that goes over the next 10 years. And that's kind of technical, but I think the simplicity of it, to your point there, is like, it's priceless. And we often overlook that, and the hardest things to execute are often the easiest by way of design, yet most complex by way of how to actually apply them.
Are you tired of feeling lost in the world of trading and investing? Get informed and inspired with the Talking Trading podcast. I'm Louise Bedford, and I'll help you navigate the markets like a pro. Tune in each week and subscribe now at talkingtrading.com.au or on your favorite podcast app, or check out the link in the show notes. Talking Trading, this is how traders excel.
Yeah, it reminds me of being young and the first Windows coming out and just clicking on a picture. And all of a sudden, everything, like Microsoft Word. Then all of a sudden, I had a Microsoft Word spreadsheet that I could actually start typing on. Or not spreadsheet, but whatever.
Yeah, that or doc or whatever.
Yeah, that was different. There was no code that you had typed in. You just click on a picture.
Yeah, well, no DOS prompt that you had to figure
behind
out.
Behind the scenes, it was like ingenious stuff happening that we didn't have to, like your cell phone. Just genius stuff happening.
Well, Apple's the king of simplicity, right? Like, I mean, Apple, that's their whole thing is simplicity. I think one of my favorite taglines we came up with, and I think this was with 1000 Watt, people work, not paperwork. Mm-hmm. Wasn't that them?
Yeah, and we worked with 1000 Watt on that.
Yeah.
Yeah, shout out to Mark and Brian if they're listening.
But that was good. And then later, Austin wrote a book called People Work, right? Wasn't that what it was?
Yeah, with Chris Smith.
Curator, right?
Yeah, Chris Smith was one of the first to really talk about the importance of technology. He had a blog. Blogs were just kind of becoming a thing at the time, and it was called Tech Savvy Agent. He just did a dynamic job at helping people think about technology and how it applied to their life. But also he focused in a simplistic way on the things that were important. And our very first trade show, actually, we met Chris and built a good relationship with him. And eventually he came on and as our chief paper killer is what we referred to him as. So that was his title. And this was, 10 years ago. But we didn't mean that as... It wasn't a marketing stunt. It was how we thought about it. And so when you start to When you look at when you look at early stage companies, they have the ability to be creative and flexible, more flexible than a later stage company might be able to be or to execute. You often see these creative attributes around their naming conventions and their product launches and how they position their product. Part of that's this element of flexibility, but the other half is they actually believe it. So long as we keep that belief system in line with how we're actually executing, beautiful things happen. So when you look at someone's title, you're like, man, why do we even have titles? I just think of myself as a, you know, builder and creator and enabler for other people. Why do we even have titles? And, I think it's that connection with how we actually think about it and how we execute it. So for Chris, he was the chief paper killer.
But as the chief paper killer, I mean, think about the environmental impact we probably had.
Yeah.
By eliminating, I mean, tons of paperwork.
We quantified at one point or another. I can't remember what the number was, but the amount of trees that get, you know, used, turned into paper, and the consumption on that is just astronomical. So we talk about, as us as a society thinks about climate change, global warming, all of these things, like we need to take into account these massive elements that contribute to the environment.
Yeah, these legacy processes and that use paper.
And yeah, for all I know, I'm no expert on paper consumption and how it applies to global warming, how it applies to climate change. That's kind of the point of the statement is we need to kind of look at things in their totality rather than using a plastic bottle versus conducting a real estate transaction in paper versus driving your car versus. So it's, I'm no expert in, you know, carbon and global warming, but
that's but we had an impact. That's for sure. I mean, there's no doubt about that. I mean, it must have been huge. I mean,
you can just make up a number. I bet that it was nine times. You saved nine times
more. I would say nine times more paper.
You know, I wrote down the nine times. That's another big aspect. People need to call out numbers that other people are throwing out. We as a society, I think we toss out numbers in a really big way. And that carries weight. And it's easy to forget how much weight numbers carry. I think numbers they're easy for us as people to digest because mm-hmm. you just have to digest a nine and that's going to stay with you. But knowing where it originated isn't going to necessarily stay with you. So the fact that you called that out was huge. I think that's a whole segment in itself. It's like how to.
Well, statistics can be manipulated.
I think
pretty easily.
If COVID's done anything, it's made people very weary of the source of statistics and what they actually mean, and what they actually represent.
Well, I could say we increased our revenue 50% year over year.
Yeah, that's easy.
That sounds pretty impressive, right? But if I went from $1 to $2, I'm not going to call out the fact that I went from $1 to $2 because that doesn't sound impressive. I'm going to say I increased my revenue 50%. So you can use data, right? But change it in a way that it sounds much more impressive. And I know Alex is over there smiling because he probably did this a bunch of times.
Well, I see it often. I think particularly in the fundraising world, there is a art and a structure and a strategy to fundraising, and you can reduce your learning curve or call it increase your success by kind of understanding some of those fundamentals, but it also applies to just mass market. We were talking about, you and I were talking about IPOs earlier, and there's a threshold at which you have to hit a certain level of revenue before you're a candidate for an IPO, which is a bit backwards, in my opinion, with respect to...
Because it doesn't apply to growth and things like that. Like, I mean, I think at the time when we were talking about doing it, I mean, that was one of Austin's goals was to IPO, but it was $50 million in revenue a year is what you had to be at in order to be considered for an IPO. And it's probably even higher now. I mean, when you think about it, I mean, things have gone, markets have gone insane. What was it last year? I think the S&P was up some astronomical amount, mm-hmm. like 40% or something great, maybe even higher than 40%. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, the threshold has probably gotten even higher. The barrier to entry into the game is probably even higher. But I mean, the ultimate goal for a startup isn't necessarily to sell to a bigger company. it's to IPO, because you IPO and that multiplies your revenue insane and your value goes through the roof. So, I mean, the goal is to do that. But in our case, you know, it made sense. The acquirer who bought Dotloop, the partnership made too much sense. Mm-hmm. In order for us to like go into another vertical, like say law, I think they estimate it would cost us about $125 million to really break into another vertical. So we were just at that point. We're like, let's just sell it.
And you're also at the that point where it's like, if we don't sell to these guys, how long until they bring a competitor to the market that can generate, can steal some of our market share? Is it worth losing the potential market share to get the money now and just be part of their umbrella?
Well, it was good for our employees too, honestly. I mean,
Yeah.
They, assuming the, I was just looking for a picture. I was thinking about this quote or stat the other day, but anyways, I think one of the greatest opportunities for company M&As is it enables a company to take their vision and amplify its impact on the world, at a quicker rate and potentially with more purity, around their original, objective. So long as the parent company also aligns and sees that vision. So when you look at M&As, you see companies that will just gobble others up and they'll roll them in as a kind of product feature. And then you'll see this approach where a company might just let the organization run as its own. And they, you know, in that scenario, they're buying that organization because they believe in its people. They believe in its vision. They believe in, it can be more successful operating as a standalone entity, as opposed to the sum of the whole, but it, in other words, has the resources of the parent company. So I would say one of the biggest benefits to Dotloop and the individuals within and the customers that we served is that we now had this large amount of resources and we were able to operate, through a long-term outlook or a long-term lens. We were able to make decisions that weren't, solely based on revenue, because collectively our revenue potential as an organization was never going to be substantial relative to our parent organization. So sure. Our value to that equation was to just go be the best version of ourselves that we could be, which meant doing more of what we were already doing, but pulling from the resources and expertise and consumer brand recognition. We were a B2B brand. Our parent company was a consumer brand. So that's a pretty dynamic makeup. Generally, you have either a consumer brand presence or a B2B business to business brand presence. So we kind of married the two, but got resources along the way. So most of the people that were there through the acquisition are either still there today or they went to another earlier stage company. So
or started their own.
Or started their own. So that's really a function of still having a love and appreciation and respect for the parent company and believing in the long-term vision, but needing or wanting or having an opportunity to take that something else, which is kind of this creative earlier stage company aspect. So for me, I think I'm always going to be an early stage company type of guy. I love that phase where you have to problem solve.
I was just going to say that solving problems, man, that's all it is. It's just solving problem after problem after problem. It's true. But talk about the free snacks, talk about the free drinks and the Starbucks setup we had at Dotloop after Zillow acquired us.
Yeah. Or, I mean, shoot, just Red Bull alone. I don't know what the Red Bull,
the budget.
I remember one point in time, people were counting the number of Red Bulls that they would have per day, which couldn't have been healthy. But yeah, Zillow takes care of their people in a pretty amazing way, and I think they set precedents for, you know, everyone else. They created a model of employee freedom and flexibility and autonomy and equality in a way that others weren't doing before. And I think so long as you have the right people around that, you can accomplish more than what you otherwise could without it. But it's obviously a different working style and structure. You can't throw someone into an environment that has just full freedom. Like, we had no vacation policy. That really doesn't work. If you're not used to having structure, unless you can understand and respect the indirect structure that is applied by not having a vacation policy.
Yeah, a lot of the operating things we didn't necessarily, I mean, none of us were like HR people and, you know, I mean, once Zillow came on, everything got a lot more structured, you know, everything got a lot more organized and structured, and everyone had their, like, we had a lot more professional people, I would say. Like, it went from this like startup to this high growth kind of startup thing with this professional company that could bring those kind of resources and specializations, professional specializations to a startup, you know, and it benefited the employees. I mean, it gave them more clarity. I mean, the money was better. I mean, we were like poverty before that.
I worked basically for 6 years without really getting a paycheck, relative to what I was putting into it, for sure. Now for me, it was because I was chasing something else, and I knew that 6 years of sacrifice was going to add to, you know, 10x the opportunity down line. So that's obviously part of the reason, but it's one of the benefits of having a parent company is you have that stability, so you don't have to chase revenue in different ways. But in parallel, as long as you have a parent company that is chasing health and wellness of their crew, their team, good things follow. So some of the immediate changes that Zillow put into effect was they had a balancing scale for how people were to be compensated, and instantly people's compensation when that merger and acquisition happened, everyone went through that process. So it provided standardization and structure as well as added benefits through that process.
Plus, people were drinking $10,000 worth of Red Bulls every year. Yeah. So
yeah.
If you didn't feel like you were compensated enough, you just ate a bunch of free snacks and drank a whole bunch. Shoot, I was guilty of coming up there like, hey, Alex, I'm coming upstairs, because I was downstairs in Longworth Hall when the acquisition, everything. And Alex would come downstairs a lot, either you or Will. Or Allie would come down a lot. And whenever there was like an event or something like that, they'd come down there and nag me about, like, and we'd spend 2 hours working on a pamphlet or whatever, just sitting there together. And they would come down and get some marketing help from me. But then I'd always go upstairs at Alex, hey, what's up, man? And he'd let me in and we'd go in and I'd free snacks. Like, but it was good times, man. And you know what the crazy thing is like when you go through something like that, and this is for, you know, everybody listening, you know, when you start a company like this, it's not just you that's going to benefit from this. Like, you think about, oh, I'm going to build this business, I'm going to make all this money, I'm going to sell it to a company, or I'm an IPO and I'm going to make all this money. You have no idea how much what you're going to do and the effort that you put in is going to help the people that work for you. You know, I was just at that conference and I met our buddy, Dan McKeon, who's now at Inside Real Estate. And Alex knows a lot of people at Inside Real Estate. They have a deal with eXp. I mean, they're providing all of the lead generation software tools mm-hmm. for eXp, and they're behind the scenes. Well, Dan McKeon, standing at his booth, he messaged me, hey, you're at eXp right now? I'm yeah, I'm here. Got together. We all went to dinner, him and his boss and some other people, but now he's in this real estate world, right? Mm-hmm. This real estate software world. And he was just a buddy of Austin's growing up, right? Him and Hunter, yeah. And all these others. Hunter's still at Dot Loop. But think about the people like Zach, him, Will, like all the people that left, started a new company, and some of them have even exited. So they got, you know, they were able to take advantage of their stock option with Dot Loop and exit that. Then they start their own companies, exit those. Alex is one of those people. Alex hasn't exited yet, but started a new company called D. Alexander. And tell them a little bit about what you're doing now, Alex.
Yeah, no, I'll back it up a little bit. So, but this is applicable to the acquisition discussion. Around the time of our acquisition, or shortly thereafter, there were a couple things that I needed in my life to stay. And I wanted the same elements that I had prior to being acquired, which was I wanted freedom and flexibility to go work from wherever. But I also wanted to take on whatever project I wanted within the company. And the team, I kind of shared that and they agreed. And I started traveling around the country, working remotely in destination-oriented environments for 1 week to 1 month at a time. And I did that for about a year. And in parallel, I was working on a number of special projects within the organization. I wanted to tackle new channels of business. I wanted to unlock new product streams. I wanted to connect the ecosystem within real estate, but within a broader business. And I did that a bit as a one-man band within a 5,000-person company, which was pretty exciting, and we accomplished great things. But what I learned through the experience was this experience of living and working remotely in destination-oriented locations was that, one, I really enjoyed that in my personal life, and I felt like the future was going to look a lot like that, in which the more and more that people could work remote, the more and more it gave them flexibility. The more and more flexibility they had, the greater likelihood of individuals buying properties or experiencing things around property in different ways. They have flexibility that they didn't have before. And if you ask yourself, why do I live in the location that I live today, or why did I previously? You can tie it back to really three different buckets. You know, work, being the need to be in a physical location, family, so being close to those that that you love or that you know. And the third is immediate family, but kids need to go out and connect with whatever they need to connect with, school. So live, work, play is what I really back it into. But when you take work out of that equation, then you amplify or enhance the way that people interact online, such as being able to do school online or actually have relationships with people online. It unlocks like a newfound freedom and a world that we can experience in ways that we weren't able to experience before. So I saw that changing. I was doing that in my personal life. I felt like that was going to continue naturally as technology progresses, as companies start to become more flexible. The only reason they weren't flexible previously is they didn't have the tools and capabilities for it to
be. They were afraid also. Because they were afraid if they were the first one to be more flexible with their employees, then they would be at some sort of a disadvantage if it didn't work out. Where when COVID happened, everybody was forced to do it at the same time. So now we know the sky's not going to fall if you let your employees work from home. So things are working out. Now they're trying to get people to go back. And I just heard Mr. Wonderful the other day talking about how he's not going to make any of his employees go back to the office. He said they don't want to. He said, and then if I tell them they have to, they're just going to leave and they're going to go somewhere else. So now you've got companies trying to get people to go back to the office and they just don't want to. And I think one of the things you did, you were ahead of this and it was going to happen. Mm-hmm. This trend was going to happen. You know, there's too many tools out there that we can take advantage of to work from home. COVID just accelerated that. And you were in a really good position to take advantage of that trend.
Yeah. So That's exactly right. I mean, we built, I built a thesis around how this change would unfold. I had a 10-year time horizon on it, and that got compressed pretty much overnight. But my thesis was focused on destination-oriented locations. I believe that people are going to want to go to beautiful locations. And it wasn't that they weren't living in beautiful locations previously. It was that people like change. Like we, by default, are creatures of change. We need change, but we also need stability, and that's where home provides us that stability. But our understanding of what home is what gives us the belief of what that stability is. So long as people could get that stability in different ways and have the flexibility in their own life and optionality to maintain that stability in beautiful locations, I believe people that we're going to be more interested in those environments first. So We focused on building a portfolio of homes in destination-oriented locations that were all different in nature, mountains, red rocks, and the beach. We picked the most beautiful locations in the country. We also had a dynamic investment thesis that applied fundamentals to that, such as drivability. So everything's within a, you know, certain duration of time from a major metro. Those were fundamentals that I was a that were from my own experience, my own life, and I tracked my behavior. And I looked at what I thought people would want and let that tell the story.
You were kind of your own test case.
Yeah, absolutely.
And it doesn't mean because you like something that everybody else is going to like something. But the change in your lifestyle that Zillow allowed, right, at first, you were exposed to something not everybody else would be exposed to, but it changed the way you looked at the world and changed the way you worked. And it said, you said, why wouldn't everybody want this?
Mm-hmm. Hey, you know, it's what's interesting about, I would say our startup experience, but everyone has this in their own way. We applied this element of flexibility, but also some formality and structure since inception. We had always had this autonomous workplace. Now we, at the time when starting the company, we had to be in at a certain time and we had fixed hours. So it was a little bit more structured than what you might see in the world today. But what was loose was our ability to execute our work. And so while there was flexibility in one way and structure in the other, at the end of the day, it's flexibility and structure. Zillow really allowed us to amplify that. But what's interesting and unique is we did that from the start. And I think the reason we did that from the start is we weren't kind of overthinking the minutia. We didn't have a predefined notion of what it should look like. We just went in and built how we believe the future should operate. And it happened to work in the direction of the way that the world was evolving anyways. So we were looking to then leapfrog or get ahead of how we saw the world. And that's what I applied at D. Alexander. There's a handful of fundamentals that are super unique to the space. But ultimately, I believe that we could identify the value that an underlying home could produce by having a better understanding of the investment thesis that was being applied. So I created an investment thesis with a consumer value proposition. Our value proposition is a consistent brand from home to home. If you're renting Airbnb or VRBO, or and I use that terminology because people can relate to it, but at the end of the day, it's a rental home. These are homes that other people own, not that corporations and brands own. Therefore, you don't have consistency in standards. Like, you show up to the home and they're all different.
Basically beholden to the ratings that they have.
Yeah. Yeah. And the ratings also in the pictures, the ratings in the pictures also don't align all the time, but that's the only thing that we have as consumers. And I wouldn't have changed that. I like to know what I'm getting when I buy something. I like to know that I'm sleeping on a certain mattress. Like, I care more about my sleep experience than I actually do the underlying home.
You know what's funny? I was in Denver randomly meeting with a buddy of mine who was in a VC here in Cincinnati. He had moved out to Denver to start investing in companies out there. I was at his house. This guy shows up and he's a startup guy and he was thinking about investing in him. I'm like, hey, what do you do? Oh, I make sheets, really nice sheets for Airbnbs and things like that. I'm like, oh, that's cool. Not knowing, this guy provided the sheets and the bedding to Alex.
No. Oh.
And then I found out about it. And I hit up Alex. I'm like, dude, your sheet guy. I'm hanging out with the sheet guy right now. He's like, what? I'm like, yeah, it's random. But yeah, that's the experience you're talking about. Yeah. And you've got a guy who makes really nice sheets, right? If I stay at one of your D. Alexander properties in Destin or Sedona, and which is where two of his main locations are, I stay at one of these places. I'm laying in this bed. I'm like, holy crap, this bed's super comfortable. These sheets are amazing. Then I go to, you know, wherever I normally stay because I'm a cheap bastard, Howard Johnson or something. And I go and I sleep on one of those beds. I'm like, I can't do this anymore. I've got to, I've got to stay at a D. Alexander place.
We tested sheets. I went to the factory. I watched them make sheets. I became a sheet expert when making that decision. But also, I worked with individuals that knew quality inside and out and that were looking at something beyond just a sale. They knew quality, and that individual was an expert in sheets, and his company was an expert in linens and also other types of terry products. But what's interesting about that company, though, around that time they were acquiring another company from Italy. They acquired a Italian linen, true Italian linen companies. That's one interesting thing that I learned about linens is you might hear Italian linen, but they're not all Italian. Like the process is an Italian from end to end, and it doesn't mean that they're not nice quality linens. It just means that they're not holistically Italian. For me, there was this element of quality with respect to the craftsmanship of Italian linens and other factors. So we invested in linens. We invested in mattresses. Our mattresses are hospitality grade mattresses. The same mattress that you're going to have at the Ritz. So we invested in the places that we know people care about. Particularly, they were the areas that I cared about personally. And I felt like that would translate over to other individuals. And sleep is the one thing that I think everyone needs, but that everyone doesn't actually value in their own life. So if they're getting away from their own primary home or their own primary residence, the one thing that we could have provided them in that moment is a great sleep experience. And if they walk away with a great sleep experience, they just got value out of that equation. So that was important to us. And
see, I'm always the one who's like price hunting. Like I love getting things as cheap as I possibly can. And I think a lot of people are probably like that too. And it's probably, you know, because of the way I grew up, it's just what I think, like, oh, you have to save money everywhere you can and then invest whatever's left pretty much. Right. And what I've come to discover over the years is that it's not always about price. It's about value overall, right? It's about what value am I getting out of this? I go to a Days Inn or something. I got a bed. There's a bed there, right? It's cheap. I can get a decent night's sleep there. But once I experience like a D. Alexander home, it's almost like it changes your life. You're like, why have I been so cheap all these years? Like I could have had this unbelievable experience, not just a place to sleep, but an experience, and also not just an experience, but an experience in an environment where I can enjoy the outdoors. I can enjoy what's around me. I'm not just, you know, sitting in a Days Inn and off the beaten path in Gatlinburg somewhere. Right. Or whatever.
Gatlinburg. It always goes back to Gatlinburg.
That's because I'm a hillbilly.
I know.
but I mean, you know, I think this is what you're trying to, this is your value prop, yeah, right?
How many properties do you guys own?
We don't talk properties. Properties are portfolios.
Sorry, what's the proper terminology?
We don't even talk about it. But we talk about the profile of the property, and markets. So we focus on consolidation within a marketplace or a level of saturation within a marketplace.
How many markets are you in? Can you tell me that one?
I would say seven today. You know, when COVID, to back up that value piece for a second, then jump forward, you know, maybe I know you too well. I've known you for 12 years, 15 years.
Probably 15, 2009, right?
Yeah. Yeah, you're a value hunter. You know, you like the deal, but really your measurement of the deal is, did I walk away with something that I appreciate, or did I get a bargain relative to the price and the discount? Like you'll spend in different places, your vehicle because you drive it every day, or this building, you know, this beautiful co-working space. I walked around today and I said, man, I haven't been here in a year and this place looks amazing. And you said, you know, have you not?
I like to spend money on my investments.
Yeah. You spend money in the right places.
Yeah.
And you also appreciate the hunt of getting the value.
We got a great deal on the building. Yeah.
But you do that across your whole life.
Mm-hmm.
But that's really unique. That's really unique. And you just touched on your upbringing. Maybe there's some connection there, but I don't think most people process information the same way that you do. Sorry. I don't think most people process information the way that you do around like looking at value and through that lens across everything, not just one thing, everything. But then you'll turn it off at places if you want to go travel. Like you travel a lot.
Yeah.
Some of it's for work, some of it's for pleasure.
And I travel because, you know, there's an experience there. I mean, it gives you something to do. You know, I don't drink. I don't sit around and get drunk at bars and do that kind of stuff. Like, I mean, that's not where I spend my money. Some people do. You know, some people find value in that somehow. But that's not what I enjoy. I enjoy seeking out different experiences through different cultures. Mm-hmm. And traveling globally, I feel like it makes you a better person. And it helps you realize just how spoiled we are here in America. And I don't think enough people have had that experience because they think this is the worst place in the world and everything's falling apart. And this is the most awful, most unfair society on the face of the earth. You need to travel, right? If you think that, you need to get out and you need to travel and you need to see what it's like in other places, but also experience those cultures because there's beauty in all these cultures. America's not, you know, the greatest country in the world for everything. I mean, there's some things that, you know, a lot of things actually that, you know, are happening in these other cultures that are really, really cool. And maybe it's not just traveling outside of the United States. Maybe it's traveling inside this country and being able to experience some different vistas, right? I want to see the Red Rocks. I want to go to down to Destin or somewhere, and I want to see the beautiful waters at Destin, right? And I want to go walk the beach and get my feet in the sand and feel the waves on my feet. You know, you too many people live in a bubble, and not just a mental bubble or a political bubble, but a geographic bubble. And a lot of people, it's too easy nowadays to get out and go somewhere, but I don't think people take advantage of it enough. And if I'm going to spend money, it's going to be, let me spend money on experiences, not things. I don't like to buy things. If I buy things, it's an investment. Like, I didn't just buy my car because I wanted to spend $1,000 a month on a nice car and drive around and be like, look at me, I got a nice car. No, I put that bitch on Turo and I'm like, I'm going to make money off this fucking car, right? A car is a depreciating asset, but I turned it into an asset, right?
What I love about you is you also share your wins.
Yeah. So, oh, I want everybody to know. I want to tell, because everybody should do it, right? But I'm going to take the L. I'll do it first if you're afraid.
But you're measuring the win. You're not just talking about the bargain. You're talking about the win and why the bargain happened, or
yes,
how you're making that profit or margin on the vehicle. And
when I'm a storyteller,
mm-hmm.
I love to tell stories. Mm-hmm. I love to constantly be putting information out there. It's my favorite. Like, I want to tell everybody.
Yep.
And I think, you know, I need things to talk about. So, and I think social media has done that for all of us, right? Social media's done that for a lot of us.
Yeah, you're a televangelist when it comes to that type of stuff. Like, now all of a sudden, like, you're like John the Baptist, and I'm like Elijah or some other like prophet. I find myself arguing pointless arguments with people online all the time now about politics, and it's just like.
But none of us have control over that stuff. Yeah.
I shouldn't do that, but it's so much fun to do it.
It is. So you got kind of my personality type too, where you love to debate people and argue. And that's probably why you got a law degree. Yeah. And Alex is not like that. Alex is like, let me just quietly build. Like, that's Alex's personality type. Let me just sit behind the scenes. I'm going to build. People aren't going to know about it. But then one day I'm going to sell D. Alexander for $8 billion. And everybody's going to be like, whoa, what the hell was Alex doing all this time? He didn't post anything on social media. He was quiet as hell.
He was traveling to Italy and finding the finest lemons.
Yeah. And now he's on a yacht, you know. But Alex does some traveling too. Yeah, you do some traveling, Alex. I mean,
it's interesting to see just how different we all are, but similar also in our own way, right? We might express it differently online or wherever, but yeah, it's fascinating. I think the internet and social in particular over the last year and a half, I think has turned into something that it wasn't 5 years ago based on how it's used and how people interact and how people engage. I think there's a lot more shouting, just making statements and claims from people as opposed to having deep conversations with people. I think you generally strike always deep conversations.
But I love to help people. I love to lead people to think more deeply about things.
Right, which is what I think social media allows you to do. None of you guys are probably wrestling fans like I was growing up. I was
a big time
wrestling nerd. Like, knowing terminology.
Hulkamania, man. That was me.
Yeah, I met him when I was 11. There wasn't a bigger athlete in the world at the time.
Oh, never. Nope.
But they, but what social media has allowed us to do is, in wrestling, they call it the fourth wall. You never, ever were allowed to break the fourth wall. You never recognized the audience. Like, you spoke, but you never really recognized the audience, and they didn't get to see the that it was real, and you didn't bring in that real life aspect of it. It was more like, these guys are characters. And eventually in the late 90s, they broke the fourth wall, and it became, you saw people like Stone Cold Steve Austin become like through the roof popular in The Rock, because they would speak to the audience and they would do these real life things where it's like, is it life? Is it not life? Brian Pillman from Cincinnati is actually the one that was
flying. Brian Pillman
was the one that was the expert at it. He's the first one. Well, social media has allowed you to do it with actual media coverage. So there's no longer, it's just you blindly follow this narrative. You have access to, you have these people that are consolidating their own research, and then you can look in, and they're journalists. That's what they're doing. Mm. So they're not gaining traction with the New York Times anymore or Washington Post, because there's a narrative that they can't drive or they won't drive. Mm. Now they're able to put it out here, and then you can go to Substack to actually where they're writing, and you're getting these little entry points, and they're poking holes in this wall that mainstream media's had since the inception, where they have access to information that we never had before.
That's right.
But now we have it.
So how do you filter out, how do you identify those experts? How do you think
that's
about that?
And that's the problem. That's what we're running into, right? Like, who's the agent of misinformation and who's not?
Yeah, who's the credible?
It's those anonymous source. Clowns right. On Twitter. Those people that say whatever they want, but you're never going to be able to punch them in the face for it because they're anonymous. And nobody knows who they really are.
Well, the worst part isn't the anonymous.
But they just antagonize.
But the worst part isn't the anonymous ones. It's the people that have been validated. And they're giving bullshit stories.
Don Lemon.
Well, Don Lemon is not an anchor. He's like Tucker Carlson, or he's...
They're all the same.
Yeah, they're personalities.
Yeah.
They're actors.
They're the WWE.
Yeah.
They're Andre the Giant. They're the fake. Well, you think it's real, but it's fake.
This was the like greatest analogy ever when it comes to this type of like pretend it doesn't exist type world that the media tries to parlay out there. Like, there was no lab leak. It was always this bat that flew 1500 miles away.
Yeah.
From 900 miles away, and forget the fact that they couldn't find COVID from any other bats.
Ivermectin's only for horses.
Well, back in the late 80s, when TBS was around, you know, it was big. They had the NWA,
mm-hmm.
and then you had the WWF, and those were the two big organizations. And every week, somebody from the NWA, who you saw on a Saturday, would all of a sudden be in WWF in a different costume, different name, and they would make it pretend like this guy just came out of nowhere.
Mm-hmm.
Totally ignoring the fact that for the last 8 months, you've been watching this guy on a different TV channel, like treating you like an idiot and expecting you just to swallow it. And everybody did. So this is what it reminds me of now, is like that whole thing was crumbling because TV was showing that, no, I know what I saw. This guy's there. Now he's here because he signed a contract with you guys. He's not some super.
That's a good point.
And so that's when you started seeing like the cartoon heroes unraveling, and people started going by like their real names and all this other stuff. That's what's going on with the media right now.
How big would Ric Flair be if he was a social media influencer now?
He's a dick.
Rick, yeah, he is, but...
I met him once.
Did you? Yeah, of course he was, dude. But Ric Flair, he's like one of these... He reminds me of these kids nowadays that, like, these fake millionaires online, where they're like, oh, I've got a Lambo and I got all this stuff, but it's, like, rented. And then they're trying to get people to think that they're some kind of guru. They're some kind of financial guru.
Have you ever watched his 30 for 30?
Mm-mm, I never watched it.
In Charlotte, he has something like a... $2 million credit line with like one or two banks, and he's mm-hmm. not paid back any of it.
Wow.
But
he was one of those guys, but back in the day, right? It was all show.
Well, he's got that famous line where he's like goes crazy on the microphone. He talks about and at the end he goes, my gators are barking. Like,
yeah,
that was all like my private jets, my limo riding, high flying. Like,
but nowadays you got Ric Flair's online. Oh, yeah. telling everybody. And that's one of the reasons, I mean, we got this podcast. I mean, we're all actually people who've done something, you know, and yeah, we're,
too, I'm just along for the ride.
Yeah. But you've had a successful career. You were early in a company. You got to see it grow, a logistics company that's now, you know, the person who started that is now the wealthiest person in Cincinnati by far, probably. I'm sure he's over $1 billion.
Yeah, we actually second quarter last year, we finally beat C.H. Robinson, which was like our goal from 20 years ago. So we beat them in quarterly revenue.
But I mean, you're in an industry that's growing in Cincinnati and growing globally.
Oh yeah. Well, we were just talking about like the value of just buying like routing lines.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah. We haven't talked about that, but so Alex, you know, what's next for D. Alexander? What are you guys looking for? How difficult was it for you to go from, you know, startup that, you know, other people were essentially, you know, running, you know, Austin went out and raised the majority of the money for us to now you're the man. It's your responsibility to go out and raise money and to build this company. What are some of the challenges? First of all, what were some of the things you carried over from Dotloop? And what were some of the things that you've had to kind of learn on your own while you're starting D. Alexander?
Yeah, it's great. Great question. I want to bring it back to
wrestling.
Number of homes. you know, around the time of COVID, I started, well, immediately. We were just in the process of bringing online our first portfolio, ramping up reservations and stays at the home, and taking our homes through our onboarding process, which applies brand standards and all of these things to the homes that make our brand, and that enable a guest to experience our home in a way that's unique to us. And around the time of COVID, pretty much immediately, I started to analyze kind of what might fall out of COVID, and I track consumer behavior changes and things like that. And I believe that it was going to dictate the next, you know, 10 years for most businesses. I actually think it's going to extend far beyond that. But the changes that I was seeing in people's lives, I didn't believe that people were going to go back to the way that they were before. Once you break human behavior, you don't go back. But more importantly, once you change the structural nature of how an organization runs, big corporations, you're not going to go back to that, because what's going to happen is you're going to pull out. You're going to see all of the things that you didn't need as an organization, which are losses and you know, costs that isn't being applied to productive outputs. And you're not going to apply. You're not going to spend money wastefully. Like, you're fundamentally going to change, and that's going to change how we live. It's going to change how we play. It's also going to change how we work. So I started reevaluating where I thought our opportunity would be to serve the biggest impact on people's lives. And we started building for that since COVID. So that meant changing the way that we think about how people utilize home, not just our homes, but home. So we've been building products to enable people to live, work for 1 month to multiple months on end since COVID hit. Pretty much immediately, we launched what's referred to as destination plans. We're looking to extend that to other people's homes. We've also been building a framework that helps people understand future value. So I say that I could say predictive value. I'm going to say future value right now. But we've always historically looked at past values. We've always historically looked at what's the value of our car today, what's the value of our home today. We haven't ever looked at what future values are, and we believe we're the best at that. My model was an investment thesis. I had an investment thesis that really spoke to revaluing things, not just homes. I applied it to homes, revaluing things, and we've proven that that's true over and over again. So now I'm looking to expand how many people we touch along the way. We believe that if we can help people understand their value or maximize their value, that everyone has the opportunity to win in that equation. And that's the one area that nobody's really thinking about.
Well, and I think to help people understand what you're talking about a little bit, revaluing what a home is worth, right? You're buying houses that are single family houses, nice houses on the beach, say, right? So the house is, say, it's $700,000, right? Once the Alexander takes ownership of it, they turn it into a business. That house is no longer worth $700,000 because you're doing several hundred thousand dollars a year potentially in rental revenue.
But it's the structural elements around it too. It's the predictability nature. It's the infrastructure. We were talking about financing earlier. Buying a home is still hard, which is mind blowing to me. It's still hard to buy a home. And I mean that through the lens of not necessarily cost. I more mean that with respect to like getting a loan or going through the process or knowing where to start. I will always be a big proponent for the real estate community, realtors, agents, brokers. People need guidance. People don't need to find the home. People need guidance through the process for someone that's been there and done it time and time again. They don't need someone to do the transaction for them. They need guidance. They need the emotional element and the expertise applied to what they're trying to do in that moment. So real estate agents, real estate brokers, anyone else that is looking to make the buying experience more seamless for consumers are needed now more than ever before. And applications are going to change what that looks like, but there's always going to be a human element in that equation so long as we know what our value is in that transaction. Well, I shouldn't call it a transaction, in that relationship with the individual that is buying a home. So for us, it was building the infrastructure, the predictability, valuing the asset. Everyone just assumed that homes were homes and that a home in Aspen is going to have the same economic value as a home in Gatlinburg, Tennessee. And that's what I saw through my experience in 2015. I was close to the residential sector. I was also very close to the rental sectors in different ways. I had people, friends and family and other individuals that were buying homes in different locations. And they were buying them either one for personal use or secondary homes, or they were buying as an economic investment because they believed in real estate, but they weren't looking at or valuing gross value. So what was unique about our investment thesis, or one of the primary problems I was trying to solve but also validate, was that a home is not just a home, and that its value will change over time based on a lot of different factors. So I built an investment thesis around that equation and have validated it since. Our assets are appreciated in a rate that's 2 times Case-Shiller. Case-Shiller is the major market measurement for home values. Our assets are going up at a 2x rate. But in addition to that, they're going up at a rate that's faster than other like homes in a market. So you can't make a claim that homes in totality are going up in value. Ours are going up at 2x rate.
And what's the reason for that? What are some of the factors that play into the reason your, okay. Is it?
If I told you, I'd have to.
Oh yeah. 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 Okay. So it's a trade secret, but
yeah, it's a lot of different factors. It's a lot of different factors, but without going into those factors at play, I mean, there's equally as much execution and operations behind that as,
but it's not necessarily something somebody listening to the podcast can duplicate without the structure of the business that you put together. It's a lot around how you guys operate,
how we operate, but it starts from, I mean, it's top down, it's bottom up. It's everything in between. And what, I mean, the takeaway for everyone on the call is, or not on the call, but on listening, a home isn't just a home. An asset isn't just an asset. A property isn't just a property. You really have to understand what you want out of it, how long you're willing to wait to get there, and also how it's going to be valued over time. I mean, one of the simplest ways to say it is, today, so if you go to get a mortgage, and this is a good baseline, if you go to get a mortgage, they're going to value that home based on permanent primary resale value, current sales. Mm-hmm. But if that home's being operated as a full-time business and it's been, and it has the infrastructure around it as a full-time cash flowing business unit, and you have multiple levels of risk mitigation and you have infrastructure and stability elsewhere that more in line with the business and not just primary income as the means for supporting that asset, primary personal income as a means for buying and supporting that asset. It should be valued like a commercial asset. It should be valued like a business. Mm-hmm. And the simplest way to frame that up is just like that and saying, you know, today the world values homes, as if they're not businesses, as if a business is a physical brick and mortar.
Making widgets of some sort.
Well, and in the same vein, for people just to give you a more of a closer real world perspective for a lot of the people starting out at the very beginning where you buy a duplex. If you have a duplex, they're going to value your duplex. They're not going to look at your rents and say, oh, you're making $1,200 a month off your rents and your net operating income like they would with a large rental property. They're going to value your duplex the same as the crappy Cape Cod that's down the street or whatever sold within the last 6 months. They don't value that as a business. So that was the obstacle that you run into with these wonderful homes that you're buying and putting your branding inside of it, is that you're battling this whole generation long marketing idea, market idea that you're telling me what I'm doing in here is the same as the guy who doesn't cut his grass as often as he should.
Yeah, exactly. And it is marketing, it's infrastructure. It's the way that the capital markets work. And, you know, if you want to buy a secondary home right now as an investment property, they're going to assess that property differently if it's an investment versus a secondary home. And the how they're going to assess that property to understand if you can buy that property, if you're credit worthy for that loan, there are variables that don't actually line up with risk. And financing is generally based on how much risk do I have as a lender to give you that loan?
Yeah, everyone has a risk profile.
It's a risk profile. And mm-hmm. they look at credit score. When your credit score can drop 75 points, if for whatever reason you don't pay a medical bill, that's not a reflection of your credit worthiness. Actually, it's probably a reflection of in the inverse way of how they would actually look at it. You might be too busy. You just assume that your insurance company was going to pay that mm-hmm. medical bill. And you were focused on building the stability in your business, but we're going to value credit score as our mechanism for determining if someone's credit worthy. So it's from top down, bottom up with respect to the reasons why this exists today. Financing is really hard because of the way that lenders nationwide evaluate risk is one factor.
It may not have anything to do with as much to do with you either as how much the risk they've already taken on.
Yeah.
Because of the way of how aggressive everybody has been with selling and buying houses now at prices that, I don't know, 2 years ago you would have laughed when you heard them. Now people are bidding against each other and driving the price even more. So now these guys, now all these banks have mortgages on their spreadsheet that I'm sure that they're slightly nervous about, because eventually the residential areas, the residential markets are going to, you know, the top's going to be reached and then they're going to start going down in value and people are going to be upside down because they're doing those fucking 5-year arms again. Like,
yeah. Oh yeah. Well, they'd love you again to an arm because they know interest rates are going to go up.
I'm more bullish on real estate than ever before, particularly residential. And,
you think it's going to keep going? You think prices are going to keep going up?
If we assess inventory, if we assess inventory and use that as a baseline, I don't want to make a prediction without probably further context or
So inventory looks like it's going to keep the prices high, just basic economics.
Yeah, I wouldn't make investment advice unless I'm the one that's pulling the trigger and going to be, you know, held accountable for the results at the end of the day. I think there's a lot more to it than just like what's going on in the marketplace. But if you look at inventory as a baseline and assume that inventory influences or supply influences demand or demand influences price or value, healthy inventory would be considered around a million units, somewhere around a million units for sale at any given point in time, residential units. Mm-hmm. Today, I haven't looked at the numbers in the last month or so, but let's just say we're somewhere around 400,000 units.
And Zillow is going to add a few thousand to that number, I think.
People are talking about Zillow too, but 7,000, I think their unit count that they 7,000 relative to 400,000.
And they're mostly in places like Phoenix.
It's a drop in the bucket. And when you look at the time that it's going to take to add 600,000 more units coupled with the supply chain constraints that are
lumber costs. I mean, supply cost. I mean, just the infrastructure, smart homes. They need devices that use microchips, and those microchips aren't available.
Is that taking into account just single family residentials, or is that living units like apartments and such as well? Those single family homes.
Yeah, I don't want to speak to that. To that number specifically, I was trying to just use as a rough baseline, but we're significantly depleted on supply. And that is one of the main assessments that that I'm using personally for a level of confidence, or for anyone that wants to explore and understand real estate, like look at the supply numbers relative to what we believe demand should be. And that's one area that gives me just very, very strong confidence. The second is people are using their real estate in different ways. When you can utilize your real estate in different ways, you also have the ability to get more value out of it. You have the ability to unlock value. We're sitting in a castle right now that is a cash flowing machine, but also an amazing deal for everyone that is a part of it, right? And that wouldn't have been the case before. This is a castle, now it's a co-working space, and everyone's getting value in that equation. So I think this degree of flexibility has turned real estate into something that's totally beyond how we ever thought about real estate today.
What I like about this, completely not transition this smoothly at all and completely go from right field to left field, I was just thinking about this popping in when you were talking about the brand, and I never brought it up. So you guys have branded the Alexander to for consistency in every place that you go to and the portfolio is going to be, the beds are going to be the same. The sheets are going to be the same. The only thing that's going to be different is the construction of the house, basically, which is amazing for somebody like me. I don't want to have a second house. I've seen guys that have second houses. They go down a day early from when all their friends come in, and they have to do all the shit they're doing at their house. Mm-hmm. That doesn't seem like a vacation house to me. That seems like a pain in the ass.
It's work.
Yeah. I know.
Yeah, it's work.
So you go, you have a house in, I don't know where your markets are, but I'll just say, let's say Naples, that I want to stay in Naples for a month. And then I'm like, the next year I want to go somewhere else, but I don't really want to get onto Airbnb or VRBO because of the inconsistencies. Now I can go to, eventually I'm sure, like Kauai or something like that for a month. Mm-hmm. And you're like, oh, well, I know exactly what I'm going to get when I get into this house in terms of like the things that I actually care about, like the bed.
Well, he's got ball players renting his stuff. And they care less about the money. They care about the experience with their family.
That's what I'm saying. Yeah.
There's too much risk. You know, you're picking up your life and going somewhere for a week with family and friends and other places. There is much more on the line for an individual that extends beyond just what they're paying for the home. It's travel. It's taking time off work. It's the opportunity cost with your family. It's what's the value of that moment worth for your family to be able to walk in and peacefully know that you're going to be able to sleep nice at night, or that, you know, every bedroom also has a bathroom with it so that you can, you know, live in the same household with multiple groups or multiple people, but still maintain this element of separation around living arrangements that you might want in your own personal life. So it's deep and involved and it's very personal. So if we can help solve that, that in itself, and it's the expectation and the consistency, knowing what you're getting every single time. And it's the look, it's the feel. It's also leading up to it, having the resources to see the floor plan. It's knowing that we're proactively thinking about the things that you care about so that you don't have to think about it. So it's the confidence that a brand should bring. When you put on a pair of Nikes, you generally think quality, and you think quality around athletics. You don't think quality around sporting shoes. So, not sporting shoes, but dress shoes. You think quality around athletics. So we know that Nikes are durable and meant for the best athletes. So we have that confidence as consumers to go in and buy Nikes and walk on any court and play with anyone that's there. That's the same level of confidence that we're looking to deliver to people. Long-term, it's packaging that up in a way that, other people can use in more flexible manners.
When I think one of the impressive things that Alex did, and you know, I help him out too with my agency, help him out with marketing and materials and design and things like that. But I think, while we were working together, when COVID happened, there was a fear there that things would change. You had to change your narrative. You had to change the way you were presenting your business. And it was big. It was a big deal. All of a sudden you had this freaking pandemic. And here you are with houses that people share. I mean, it was scary.
Well, pandemic, the health side of it, but also the
financial.
We had never experienced something like COVID as a society, as humanity has never experienced it today, in that way. So we had to learn on the fly. Airbnb acted one way. We acted a different way. Airbnb basically canceled. They waived all agreements that were in place with existing host and guest, or call it.
I remember that.
They changed the policies that they had in place previously. What that did was kind of naturally everyone's going to cancel, right? Like, it doesn't matter who you are. You're going to cancel something. You're just going to rebook. Right. If you booked a year in advance before, why don't you just cancel and rebook? You're likely going to get a better deal in that equation. So that kind of sent people into a frenzy. And what we actually saw that moment was a huge spike in people saying, hey, I want to come here for a month. I want to come here for 2 months. I want to come here for 4 months. And
I want to get out of the busy city I'm in. And I'm going to, if I'm going to lock myself and my family down for a month somewhere, it's not going to be in the middle of New York.
Yeah. I don't really feel like riding the subway right now.
No, it's going to be somewhere in Florida.
We took some heat. A lot of people said to me, don't promote stays at your properties right now. The message from experts would have been that it's brand suicide. And I just put my human hat on and said, look, people need a place to stay. We are not designed to live in our home 24/7 with our family while working. And we're also not going to stay isolated in an environment that we know inside and out, right? Our kids are going to be running next door to the other kids.
They're going to get bored.
I'm amazed that people are still doing that, though. Like that's to me is mind blowing that people are still so concerned that they're like, have basically excommunicated themselves away from the rest of society. Not to turn this into a COVID thing, but that's you were seeing something that there were a lot more people back then that were saying, well, you don't want to be around each other because it's the droplets and it's this and it's that. You were like, no, they're not going to want to be in their 1500 square foot apartment. They're going to want to get out and
spread out,
moving. Well,
yeah. So my big takeaway just immediately with COVID was people need to distance themselves. And that might be a good thing also, regardless COVID or not. Like there's benefits to being in different places that are distanced from what you know today. So physical distancing, our homes naturally, we're in remote locations, drivable locations. People need to be able to drive. Like they can't get on a airplane and go. They need to be able to pack up and go and drive from point A to point B. Naturally, our homes fit that profile. They need a home that is designed for them to live in, but also functionally execute their lives. So being able to work, our homes are equipped naturally with the best tech and latest in tech, but they're also functionally laid out for more than just living. They're laid out for function. But health and wellness, like, people need to be outside. People need to be happy. People need to be in pleasant places with their family. And it's stressful. I think it was a stressful time for individuals to try to take this home that was once just for living and then retrofit it into this place for work. And then you're used to your kids being at daycare all day. And then now they're at home all day. And like, that's a crazy experience for people. And what we were trying to do was help make life a little bit easier for people. And we came out stronger as a result.
So what were you, what was the biggest challenge with that, with investors?
You know, fortunately, just I would say one takeaway for anyone that's looking to start a business is, and if you're raising capital, align yourself with the right people early. Fortunately, I aligned ourselves with the best of the best in every category. And that has enabled us to have a great support system around how we think about building and scaling the businesses, but also helps you through times like COVID. Even if that means just giving you the freedom and flexibility to go run in a time mm-hmm. where most people might want updates. I was fortunate to have a group of individuals around the company that said, "Hey, go run, like, go run. We put our trust in you and the company." So for us, it was really just focusing on the consumer, focusing on consumer pain points and how we could provide the most value in that moment to consumers. And by consumers, I really mean households, groups and households. And our shareholders really got behind that.
Yeah, so I'm assuming that most of your shareholders were fairly experienced with how the startup scene goes and the necessity of the pivotability of the operator, really.
Yeah. You know, at the first phase of our business, I wanted to surround the company with operators as opposed to primarily institutions out of the gates. I felt like having operators around us and that are from closely tied verticals would enable us to go further, faster together, but also provide a level of alignment along the way. And when you're aligned with great people, things are not only easier, but it's more fun. Like when you're aligned with someone, things happen differently. And I think that has been a primary pillar of my entrepreneur journey, just in general across the board, but particularly over the last couple of years, that has been a key area.
Well, even at Dot Loop, I mean, we had a lot of people who busted their butts. I mean, they worked really hard. I mean, shoot, you guys, and Austin would call me up in the middle of the night and be like, "Adam, you got a minute? Like, I got to get this thing done," right? It'd be like 11:30 at night. And it'd be like, "I got to get this thing done. Hey, I just had another idea for, you know, we got the, mm-hmm. there's going to be a convention tomorrow, but we need to get this thing done today. What do you think?" You know, I mean, that's the kind of like team you have to have. That's kind of dedication you have to have when you're doing a startup. I mean, you don't have time to waste. You know, your competitors have an advantage over you because they've got more people, they've got more money and more resources. They got more brand recognition, and you've got to figure out a way to seem bigger than you are.
And a small team that's aligned around that can outflank any company. It doesn't matter the size. It doesn't matter the scale. You're faster, you're agile. You can execute things that big corporations wouldn't be able to execute just due to their raw size, but you're also going to see the world through a different lens. And I'm a big believer in the necessity and the value that comes with an insane amount of alignment. That doesn't mean alignment around everything. I think some of the best relationships also agree and disagree in a lot of ways, but they have this underlying sense of alignment in different places where they can disagree healthfully or in a healthy way, but purposefully, in that they know where the underlying alignment is and they don't even need to talk about the alignment, right? Like the alignment just keeps things on track and they can move past any friction or disagreements. They know how to turn obstacles into opportunities. They know how to take, challenges and reposition them along the way, to the extent that a challenge doesn't even seem like a challenge anymore. Friction doesn't even seem like friction anymore. A roadblock doesn't even seem like a roadblock anymore. You start to change roadblocks, challenges, friction. You flip your mindset into, man, that's an opportunity.
When you stay customer focused, and I think what happens there is it gets rid of a lot of the egos in the room. So you can have egos. I mean, any startup, you always got a guy who thinks he's smarter than everybody else, generally an IT person. But, you know, you've always got folks that are, you know, think they're the smartest person in the room. Well, and those people could rub other people the wrong way. But if your business is customer focused, it, you know.
And not everyone's meant to be in an early stage company, and that's okay. No. I think a lot of people like the idea of an early stage company. But it's not for everyone. And I think for us as a society, it's really important to look inwards and say, what do I enjoy? Like, what am I actually chasing? Am I really ready to take that jump? Taking the jump is the hardest part to start a business. Cutting off your fixed income, especially when you have a family and other responsibilities on the line, that is a big, big step. That's why I'm always going to be a proponent of keeping your nut low. Doesn't matter how much money you have, keeping your nut low gives you flexibility and freedom to go do other things.
Exactly why I still live in the hood. People say, why do you live in the hood, Adam? I said, well, I'm afraid it'll limit me. If I go out and I got a $10,000 a month mortgage.
And it keeps you hungry.
It keeps you hungry because everybody else around you is still kind of struggling. And you're like, instead of being in this neighborhood where you've got to keep up with everybody else. Oh, Bob next door just bought a brand new Lexus or whatever. Now I got to get something nice, you know? So, I mean, it kind of keeps you hungry. It keeps you open to the possibility of doing another startup, because the money I spend on a new house could be an employee, two employees.
And being quick to, just one thing for people listening as we talk about, finding alignment, if you're looking for alignment in your own life, or if you're starting a business and looking for alignment out of your partner, generally all forms of business, the biggest challenges are around people in some way, shape, or form, but also the biggest source of progress is around people as well. So we should all be focused on how do we further our relationships with the people within our organization? How do we increase the fluidity of how we all work together? People are right at different stages of the life cycle of a business. I mean, for me, I love the early days. Like, I love the early days. They're the hardest. Mm-hmm. But I love them because I know that those are the most important to driving long-term success. And if you can't get through the early days and lay that foundation, you're never going to make it.
You got to have good people in the early days. This is what I tell people with Dot Loop. Matt, our co-founder, Matt, the amount of time that dude put in for equity, didn't get paid, right? For a long time, him and Austin eventually went full-time with Dot Loop. But the amount of time he went in to build a technology in Java, which is like one of the most expensive types of people to find and the rarest type of, I mean, how hard was it at Dot Loop for us to, it was Steinbrenner we found and, you know. You
can find Java developers at that time, which is fascinating about the world that we live in today, is you can build products, websites, and apps in different ways that you couldn't.
Back then. We had different challenges. We had a big technology hurdle we had to get over, and luckily we had a co-founder who's willing to bust his ass. You know, I'm willing to, as a designer and the marketing guy at the beginning, able to, you know, pick up the phone at 11 o'clock at night and sit there on the phone with Austin and bust out some design work. And, you know, Austin, obviously, you know, he's a freaking animal and likes to go out and talk to people and meet people and raise money and that kind of stuff. I mean, you needed those people and we all complimented each other. And then to be able to bring in his brother, you know, Alex, who was willing to bust his ass, and guys like Hunter and, you know, friends who knew the goal and understood the value of the business that we were trying to build and were willing to put in the effort, you know, and early on, that's really hard. That mix is really hard.
Having that sense of alignment, that's, you see a lot of early stage companies, they bring in people they know and or that they've worked with in the past. It's because you can cut down that curve, right? You know, just by bringing in a friend that you at least have the interpersonal stuff. You guys know how each other work. Right. You, whether or not it's in business or friendship, there's some underlying fundamentals that you need to know in order to work together. They're different fundamentals, but they can translate over.
TQL, like our four of our top six guys all played on the same high school football team together at McNick. So, I mean, they were lifelong friends.
There you go. And
it wouldn't surprise me if those guys are the top guys, because they all also know how to compete with one another in a healthy way.
Yeah.
Right.
And play off each other's strengths.
Well, the best thing that, in my opinion, I hope I don't get fired for this, but the best thing that Ken ever did was bring in Carrie Byrne, who's one of his best friends. And Carrie made it, you know, Carrie put it on this, he didn't put it on like a rocket ship. He put it on like a Tesla rocket ship that you could take up and land with all these different projects and all these different verticals that they started looking into. I mean, it's taken 15 years for some of the verticals to take off, but I mean, getting to 8 billion this year in sales isn't going to be out of the question.
That's insane. Well, Alex, you know, we've been doing this for almost 2 hours now. And, what do you want to leave people with? First of all, what's next for D. Alexander? And then what advice do you have for someone out here that wants to get something off the ground, no matter what it is?
You know, right now is it's a once in a lifetime opportunity. We're not going to have it again. And I believe the next year is going to dictate the future. And it's a once in a lifetime opportunity because we've went through fundamental shifts and changes with respect to how people live, work, and play, social changes, but also technical advancements are starting to come to a head. A lot of changes in fintech, a lot of changes in application development, computing, like the rate at which we can compute information. So I think it's a once in a lifetime opportunity. And if you're thinking about what's next, really understand what you want to chase and get clear on that. I think that clarity is really challenging to figure out at times, but it's super important. Are you looking for stability and to spend time with your family over the next 10 years, or are you looking to spend time with your family in a way that's different than how you do today 20 years from now? Like getting clear on those little details that feel very little, but that also dictate how you can execute the next step and whatever you're chasing in life. Getting clear on that, I think it's very important. And now is a once in a lifetime opportunity. I didn't learn that clarity until later on in my career. Fortunately, I had great people around me. So that's the last thing I would leave people with is find someone that you can create with and or create with a purpose, and surround yourself with people that are behind you, or surround yourself with people that you share alignment with. So the people that you're around is super important. We can't underestimate that personally, professionally. And that also applies to the information that we read and see online and how we interpret that. And if you're looking to take your future career in a different direction, just remember the opportunity is there for everyone. And many of the people that came before us and created unique and amazing things, they weren't any smarter than you. I think keeping that in the perspective.
A lot of them were C students.
Yeah.
You know, some of them didn't even go to college.
Most of them just looked at the world a little bit differently, and they had something that put them over the edge. They took that jump. Taking that jump is the hardest. Once you take that jump, driving it forward is super important. So a lot of opportunity in the world. We have the ability to do good and make an impact, so long as we can understand.
And D. Alexander, you're not even raising money now. I mean, you got plenty. You got access to.
Yeah, we've been working on
really whatever you need.
We've been working on a number of super exciting products. I'm releasing those. I will be sharing those over the course of the next couple of weeks, couple of months, and throughout next year. And we're providing tools that kind of extend beyond our core business, which will be made available to both businesses and as well as people that are looking to build businesses and or economic value along the way. Mm. So super excited about the future. It's a combination of data, tech, algorithm, all wrapped into one business model, all wrapped into one. And we'll be releasing that over the next couple of months and sharing some new markets, new portfolios, things like that. Super excited.
So tell people how they can, you know, keep track of what you're doing and maybe if somebody wants to rent one of your places, test it out.
Yeah, absolutely. DAlexandercapital.com is the investment side of our business. So I spoke to our investment thesis and whatnot earlier. That's represented through
D is in the letter D, yeah, Alexander.
D is in the letter D, AlexanderCapital.com. And then our consumer brand is StayDAlexander.com, StayDAlexander.com. Or you can find me on Twitter, Alex D. Allison, on Twitter, LinkedIn as well.
Awesome. Well, Alex, thanks for being here. Thanks for, you're normally in Denver. That's home base for you right now, but, you were in town. So I thought I'd snatch you up and bring you into the castle and we'd do a little podcasting.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah.
This was great.
Yeah.
Till next time.
All right. See you guys.
Peace.
Thanks for joining us on this week's episode of Side Hustle City. Well, you've heard from our guest. Now let's hear from you. Join our community on Facebook, Side Hustle City. It's a group where people share ideas, share their inspirational stories, and motivate each other to be successful and turn their side hustle into their main hustle. We'll see you there, and we'll see you next week on the show. Thank you. Oh,